you know, magic word. The words that you're told up to a certain level are the secret words of the science of Freemasonry. You're told, oh, no, it's not like that at all. You know, you've been led down the garden path. I mean, it is a bit like a pyramid sales operation. And, of course, it does cost you a huge amount of money.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Now, hundreds of ordinary people in the southwest are continuing to give up their free time to campaign against the proposed new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point near Bridgewater. And I'm joined now by Nikki, who's one of the campaigners. Hi, Nikki, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
Tell us how you got into campaigning around nuclear issues.
Well, I live in a town called Bridgewater in Somerset, and just after I had my son, the house that I moved into, I discovered that at the end of the road where I lived was this massive like crane, and it's where they move nuclear waste from the lorries that take it from the power station to transfer it to Sellafield, right next to the school that my son went to. And so that's when I started to get involved.
Now, that sounds a bit bizarre. So they're bringing the nuclear waste by road right into the centre of Bridgewater. I mean, the idea, obviously, Hinkley is way out of the way, so that it's away from people, and if there's anything dangerous happens, it's away from a population centre. But they're taking actually the most radioactive waste it right into the middle of Bridgewater. And are you still living there, or did you move somewhere else in the town?
You can't move far enough away, can you? I think it's obviously only about protecting populations in places like London and maybe possibly Bristol. It seems that the population in Bridgewater is irrelevant.
Well, I mean, Dumble, for example, is just outside Bridgewater. There's no reason why, for example, they couldn't stick a little railhead in Dumble, and if they're going to move it there, they can move that there by road quite safely, and it's away from a population centre. It seems to me they're saying that actually these nuclear flasks, which contain the spent fuel rods, which intensely radioactive, that they're quite safe.
Well, actually, what they're saying, Tony, it's an interesting point that you make, because every other nuclear power station in this country, in England and in Wales, have their own, well, I don't know about Wales actually, but definitely in England, they all have their own railheads within the station grounds. So I don't know if it was a cost cutting thing, but for me, it raises an issue about accountability, because I think that the people in Somerset have been sold short by the local authorities, by the politicians, in allowing the stations to be built without such a facility.
Yeah, when I came on the phone to you, Nikki, to try and persuade you to come up here, which you've done, thank you very much for today, you were actually inside some kind of suit, nuclear protection suit. What were you doing?
Oh, crikey. We were probably protesting, I would imagine, if I was wearing a suit, as we're prone to doing. Remind me when we were.
Well, this is just a few weeks ago. And I phoned you and you said, I can't really speak to you with the phone because I've got a nuclear protection suit on.
Oh, yeah. I was dressed as. I had a radioactive waste barrel suit on, and I was actually in London. And I'd gone down there because right now the government are consulting, apparently, if you can believe that, they're consulting about what to do with the waste. And so, as your listeners may or may not be aware, the government's plans to build a tranche of new nuclear power stations are resting on the government's belief that a geological disposal facility will exist to accept all the waste. Now, we've got a legacy of like 70 years worth of waste in a really bad state in Sellafield. And, you know, never mind the legacy waste. We haven't even sorted out the legacy waste, never mind creating somewhere that could accept new build waste. And so they had a process, which, again, as every process they've ever had about the radioactive waste, it always seems to want to dump it in Cumbria. So they don't want to move it very far. They just want to get it off the Sellafield site and dumped very close to Sellafield. Cumbria, a very pro-nuclear local authorities, actually, the Cumbria County Council, I think, Sellafield's something like an employer of about 10,000 people. So it's a very big employer in a very remote area. So people are very dependent on them. So even though they wanted to host the dump, they didn't actually feel able to because of the lack of information, the lack of clarity, the lack of suitable geology. So we went to London and we took a big banner that read, how about a nuclear waste dump here? We stood outside Parliament and we stood outside Buckingham Palace, and we stood a few places with this high-vis coloured barrels and banners on.
Okay,
and that's what we're doing.
Now, I've also heard recently, I think it's just this week, that the local authority up in Cumbria, where Sellafield, where all this nuclear waste ends up, have decided they don't want the nuclear waste to end up. Now, this has left the government in a bit of a difficult situation because they have nowhere to put this waste. Nobody wants it.
Well, the undertone of it, Tony, actually, is that I think they intend to do just as the German government has done and to impose it on a community. You know, nuclear academics and experts from all over the world for about the last 20 years have all said that one of the obstacles to us sorting out the problem of the legacy waste, so the legacy, if people don't understand what I mean by legacy, is the radioactive waste that we've already made. So it's here, we can't put it back in the box, so to speak, so we have to do something with that waste. And what the experts argue is that every time we try to look into what to do with that waste, over-ambitious industry people or politicians all decide to use that search as a justification to produce more waste. And so every time they try and have a hunt for somewhere, it kind of inevitably the search grinds to a halt, because it's a very different ethical proposition to create more waste when the solutions that they moot for the waste, they're not really solutions. I mean, the government would talk about a geological disposal facility and say, in fact, in their consultation document, they say that a dump will ensure that future generations are protected from that radioactive waste. Now, that is a complete and utter lie. The science around geological disposal is not certain, it's not known, and one of the problems is because it's radioactive for such a long time into the future. Now, people like to say tens of thousands of years, they're orders of magnitude wrong, we're talking millions of years, and obviously you can't predict what's going to happen then, and so that creates a huge amount of uncertainty. And so what we know is that when we dump it, eventually it will leak. It doesn't matter how good your containers are, it doesn't matter how good your geology is, eventually that stuff will leak, and it will leak out into the environment, and it will be moved by the water through the rocks over a period of time. And so it's not contested by scientists that a repository leak. What is a hot source of topic is when it will leak and how, and what the implications of that will be.
But it's got to go somewhere, hasn't it? Where are you, any thoughts about where it should go?
I've heard all sorts of ideas, from shooting it into the sun, through dropping it into volcanoes.
Hang on. If you drop it in a volcano, might it come back with a load of boiling rock in your face?
Oh, well, these are the ridiculous ideas that Corum looked at. I mean, they say that Corum was. Corum was a committee on radioactive waste management that was formed just in around 2003, and it was quite groundbreaking in some ways, although there were a lot of criticisms about some of the appointments and the fact that government appointed them. Some of the work they did about engaging members of the public and stakeholders to find a solution was quite progressive, and they came up and so they said that they started with a clean piece of paper, but they didn't. The ideas for them to look at were already on the table, so they included sticking it in volcanoes, sticking it into subduction zones, shooting it into the sun.
Hang on, okay, what's a subduction zone?
Sorry, a subduction zone is where the crust of the earth that is underneath the oceans. So one of the, you all know about earthquakes, and earthquakes happen because of a thing called plate tectonics. So that is, if you imagine the earth's crust as being different plates, they slide around, and the heavier ones, the lighter ones, get subducted underneath the heavier ones. This tends to happen at the coast. So if you look at the Pacific Rim and Japan's a very good example. Japan, you've got four different plates meeting, and so the Japan Sea is actually a subduction zone. It's slowly.
So the idea is you plonk them on the seabed, one of these places, and they slowly slide underneath the Earth's crust. Is that the idea?
Kind of, yeah. Except that the processes of subduction are extremely slow, and it would leak before it would be, so it wasn't a viable idea. In fact, very little of the ideas they looked at were viable, and as a result of that, so what you have to understand about geological disposal is when they started making nuclear waste, they had a fantasy that some poor schmuck in the future was going to come along and sort it all out. So they didn't pay much attention.
But they were waiting, really saying, well, surely someone's going to come up with the technology to get rid of it.
Technological optimism, yeah. You know, we're human, we're great, we're going to sort this stuff out. They didn't pay much attention to sorting it out, but they did put a lot of effort into making more. And so the nuclear industry, around the 1970s, they started to have a look into this accumulating waste problem that they were starting to get. And ever since the 1970s, the nuclear industry has favoured geological disposal, digging a big hole in the rock and dumping it as a solution. So that's the history. So what we're looking at now is still the nuclear industry's favourite solution. We're opposed to deep geological disposal. We wouldn't say that our position wouldn't change in the future, but in the current state of knowledge, the current research, where things are at now, we do not support that route.
Well, Cumbria doesn't seem to either. I mean, a story on the BBC website from November the 25th this year, nuclear waste repository, Cumbria attacks the government move. Cumbria County Council branded the government's decision to exclude it from discussions over the search for an underground nuclear waste store was outrageous. The authority officially responded to the Department for Energy and Climate Change over the revised search process, which was announced in the summer for a nuclear waste depository. In January, the County Council voted against staying in the talks. The government then enacted district councils to make the decision. In January, the County Council's cabinet voted 7-3 against staying in the process over fears it could not secure the right to withdraw at a later stage. It also wanted firm agreements about community benefits. So there was a democratic process, they say, which was carried out, culminating in a decision at the end of January. But it looks as though the government didn't like that decision, so they're inventing a new process that will exclude that level of council, the county council that took the decision.
Yeah, so that's exactly. So this is why we keep ending up in Cumbria, is because basically that's where the waste already is, and that's where the government wants it to stay. One of the things you have to understand about the Quorum, the Committee on Radioactive Waste Management's original recommendations, is that they said in the current state of knowledge, GDF, it was the best they could come up with, i.e. the other ideas were just so ludicrous as to be quite laughable, like dropping it into volcanoes or shooting it into the sun. So although they said that in the long term that was the best that we could come up with, they also knew that because of the uncertainty, it probably wouldn't be particularly politically possible to site a GDF, and they acknowledged that. And one of the things that they said was GDF had to be a strategy, but what you had to do first was you had to do storage. You had to build good, hardened storage, interim storage. You had to immobilise the waste. So for example, in Sellafield, you've got massive ponds full of all sorts of waste. I mean, some of it, the cleanup that they're doing now on the first generation Magnox stuff, 20 years before they can even get the fuel. That's 20 years.
So how much of this high level nuclear waste is there actually hanging around?
Oh, you're going to ask me statistics now, and I'm not going to be able to pull them off the top of my head. I think it's about 100, maybe about 100 tonnes, 120 tonnes of plutonium at Sellafield.
Okay.
So there's a massive amount.
There's lots of that. But anyway, look, let's just focus down on Hinkley specifically for a minute, because we've just heard in the Financial Times that Brussels is going to probe a UK nuclear power plant deal. Brussels is, this is Guy Chazan and Alex Barker's article, launch a full investigation into whether the contract for Britain's first nuclear power plant in a generation offers illegal state support, casting the project into doubt until at least next summer. Joachim Alumina, EU Competition Commissioner, is preparing to announce the probe as early as next week, according to people involved in the case. The deal that's under scrutiny is a contract signed in October between the UK government and French utility firm EDF for Hinkley Point C nuclear power station in Somerset. When built, it should provide 7% of the country's electricity. Agreement guarantees EDF's strike price of £92.50 per megawatt hour, roughly double the current wholesale price of power for electricity produced at the £16 billion plant over a period of 35 years. So it looks like Brussels isn't having any of this, or at least is going to have a good look at it before they allow it to start, this deal between the British government and EDF.
Yeah, and here we go. This is the smoke and mirrors that's been going on about the nuclear project. So, nuclear came back on the coattails of climate change, and the government promised that we would only do it if there would be no subsidy, and they are still denying the subsidy. But the fact that Europe have got to look at it is because it is a subsidy. And also, Tony, the government didn't sign any contracts in October. That article is incorrect. there will be no contract signed until it's been approved by Brussels. So all of the fanfare that when they announced the strike price, David Cameron coming to visit Hinkley, that's all to give people the illusion, to keep that illusion in place that this is a done deal, there's nothing you can do about it, it's all going ahead. EDF had planning permission to begin the build since March this year. Before they acquired planning permission in March this year, 2 years ago they acquired planning permission to begin the groundworks because they argued climate change was such a terrible threat and so immediate that you had to start building it before you got permission.
But are you saying climate change isn't a threat?
No, I'm not saying it's not a threat, but I'm very cynical about the industry's claim. So, for example, if the climate change argument that they're... Well, not the climate change argument, that's the wrong thing to... How do I phrase it? Climate change, obviously, is a very serious issue. And a lot of us who oppose to nuclear power, what we've said all the way along is that if you're serious about climate change, nuclear power is not the way to go. They take too long to build. Do you know what I mean? They're never built on time.
Yeah, but they do deliver massive amounts of energy.
Well, actually, they, you know, they're not a green solution, Tony. You know, the government don't like to look at the front end of the cycle or the back end. What they look at is how much carbon is produced when you're burning the uranium in the reactor. There is a massive amount of fossil fuel used in the exploitation of uranium. To get a piece of uranium the size of my fist, you are probably going to have to mine an area probably as big as a few of the buildings around here, just to get a little bit as big as my fist. You know, it's a massive amount of rock that they have to trash in order to get the uranium. Then you have to ship it around the world. You have to enrich the uranium, which is a hugely energy intensive process. And then there's the waste. I won't even discuss how much carbon dioxide Sellafield uses, or how much gas it burns, or how much water it uses in keeping the waste cool. We do not know what the carbon footprint of the waste management over the next hundreds of thousands of years is going to be. So the claims that nuclear is green are completely unfounded.
Okay, so look, I'm going to put this $64,000 question to you. So what other forms of energy? Because I mean, what we're told is, anyway, whether it's true or not, difficult to know, but the lights are going to go out unless we have something like this very concentrated form of energy. And this is really the highest technology when it comes to power generation. You have one nuclear power plant will serve several counties.
Well, you know,
a wind farm won't do that.
The thing is, they can actually, Tony. And if you're going to look at Germany to see what's happening, if the lights go out in this country, it'll be because of the ineptitude of politicians, not because we don't have the technology available. We are 5 years behind in our thinking. This is what there's a guy called I can't remember his name. He does the renewables world status report. And what he says is that we're 5 years behind in our thinking. So right now in the UK, we're still talking about technology. Does the technology exist? Can we do it? That argument's moved on. It's no longer about that. There is more money being invested in renewables than fossil and nuclear combined. That is worldwide. In Germany, there is a massive energy transition that has been well underway for over a decade. Germany gets a significant amount of its energy from renewables already. By 2050, I mean, like 5 years ago, Germany were projecting that they would be 50% renewable by 2050, or achieving 50% of their carbon targets. I can't remember which one it was, but they're actually on target to smash that now. And this is just since that they've announced, you know, that they will turn off all of their nuclear reactors.
Well, another one of the things that the Germans are doing, of course, is actually decentralising their energy.
Yes, 50%
of... They're saying that each individual house is quite easy for them to be able to generate wind power, solar power, this kind of thing.
50% of the renewables in Germany are community owned, and this is the heart of it. Okay, this is the heart of the issue. The guy who, in Germany, who got through their Renewables Energy Act is a gentleman called Hermann Scheer, and what he said, and this is the battle that is going on, and it's going on in this country and it's going on in Germany, and it's very, very evident. You've got the big utilities who like their big centralized power stations. They own the extraction, they own the power generation, and they own the distribution. And so they call it vertical integration in the industry. all so
it's a
they
bit like
make,
it's a bit like the old Rockefeller family and their vertical integration in the oil industry, where they owned the oil fields, they owned the petrol stations that the oil was going to, they all owned the railways that were distributing their fuel, and they also owned the refining process. So if you own the whole thing, you can charge what you want.
Yeah, and this is the exact problem we're faced with. So all of the shouting saying that we can't do it, the technology just doesn't exist, you can't do it, you can't cover the place in wind farms, it comes from, I mean, in this country particularly, it comes from the nuclear industry. And what I mean by that is, do you remember Margaret Thatcher? I'm sure everyone here does. Her press secretary, as was then, is a gentleman called Sir Bernard Ingham. And he is also a very big supporter of nuclear energy. And if you remember the politics around the miners' strikes, Thatcher wanted to smash the miners. And so she wanted to use nuclear power to do that. So they introduced the non-fossil fuel obligation, the NFFO. So they did that to smash the miners, and she, you know, she wanted a tranche of 10 nuclear power stations. But what happened was in the introducing the NFFO actually also was an enabler for renewables. And so Sir Bernard Ingham started then attacking wind power. He set up a group called the Country Guardians. You can find out about this if you check out Corporate Watch or Spin Watch. You can find out about Sir Bernard Ingham and his connections with the nuclear industry and the anti-wind movement. He was the father of the anti-wind movement. Movement, and what a crap movement that is, excuse my language, in this country.
I just have to apologise to listeners for using that language. But the fact of the matter is that these wind farms are actually very unsightly. People, I mean, we've just heard a Cotswold councillor talking about how a gravel extraction pit was set up behind his house, and he didn't want the a big bank of earth where the field had been. I mean, actually, for a lot of people, they don't want to see wind farms. They want a nice view without them. And in a way, they're rather like having a load of power pylons going past your house.
Well, all I can say, Tony, is you can't eat or drink a view. And it's not a question of not in my backyard. We are living in the times where it's a question of what in my backyard. Okay? We are faced with fracking. We are faced with nuclear. We have had 50 years of not living with the consequences of our energy consumption. We get to not look at where the coal is mined. We get to not look at where the oil is exploited from. We get to not see or experience the environmental damage that is done as a consequence of that extraction. Now, wind, even all of the renewable technologies involve some extraction. They're made out of metal, for goodness sake. But a wind farm, you can put a wind farm up, your cows can graze in the field around it. You know, when you've done with it, when you find a better way of generating electricity, you can simply remove the mast. Now, in this country right now, we're faced with nuclear, which we can talk about health and the impacts of that also if you want. We're also faced with fracking. One of the concerns about fracking is about radioactive pollution of the water. So you can't say that radiation is okay, you know, is a problem when it comes to fracking, but hey, it's good for you. When it comes to nuclear power, radiation is inherently dangerous. Ionizing radiation is dangerous. When you mine and you dig right down into the ground, you disturb processes that are going on that create that radioactivity and that are supposed to be kept separate from humans. So if you want electricity, if you want it, then you have to decide how you're going to generate it. Now, these people who don't want to look at wind turbines, you know, how long have we been looking at pylons and telegraph poles and all of the other utilitarian infrastructure that we're surrounded by?
Now, Martin, a couple of stories just over the last few weeks. Mark Leftley has been writing about the Hinkley debacle in The Independent. First of all, consultants pocketing £8 million in fees for the new nuclear plant in Hinkley, and also a fury over FTSE 100 blacklist at Amex role in the £8 billion nuclear plant.
Well, I'm not actually familiar with those two stories, but I would point out that the economics of nuclear power have never stacked up. It's the elephant in the room. Why is the government subsidising something? We're told that we haven't got any money to pay for people to live in adequate-sized properties and so on, but we're subsidising nuclear power. And of course, that's a non-market argument.
I mean, before anything's even happened,
before anything's even happened,
8 million pounds has been spent on fees to broker this deal, and we've just heard from Nikki that contracts still haven't been signed, and also blacklisted AMEC, their role in possibly building this plant. Just to explain why people might be worried about a blacklisting firm doing that kind of work.
Well, because when they come to build the plant, will there be fair employment practices carried out on the construction?
Not
we know
likely.
That 3,500 construction workers have been kept off construction sites over the last 15 years, denied work as a result of their trade union activities. And it shouldn't be a surprise that big organisations which are trying to dominate the political agenda like this are also the kind of organisations that engage in blacklisting of trade union activities.
If it's also uneconomic, as you say, why are the government still pursuing this?
Because what happens if you start funding an industry? I mean, we talked about nuclear waste earlier. The amount of money spent on nuclear waste management is enormous.
Yes,
it's absolutely
half
enormous.
Half of DEC's budget.
I've read stuff which I haven't got the figures at the
top of my head.
But I mean, they're talking about something like 2p in the pound on income tax to manage nuclear waste in Britain.
48 pence a day to manage nuclear waste in Britain, compared to, I think, is it 12 and 14 pence for offshore.
So in other words, we're going through this whole social row and argument about how we're going to save money, the deficit's out of control, all the rest of it. Oh, we'll have to cut the welfare bill, that means that we're not going to pay people, give people decent housing, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, 2p in the pence on income tax, in the pound on income tax, is being sent managing existing nuclear waste. People have no idea in this country what the money's spent on. They think it's all spent on single mums. No, yeah, it's spent on nuclear waste.
Nikki, yeah, can you just tell our listeners whereabouts we can find you online and whereabouts follow the campaign?
You can follow the campaign on, there's quite a few places. There is stophinkley.org. There is southwestagainstnuclear.wordpress.com. There is stopnewnuclear.org. There was quite a large number of anti-nuclear campaigning websites. Southwest Against Nuclear are based here in Bristol, and Stop Hinkley are based down in Somerset and in the Bridgewater and surrounding area. And Stop New Nuclear is a national umbrella organisation of many anti-nuclear groups working on weapons, working on waste, working on power, and all of those aspects, as well as groups like Rising Tide, who are committed to fighting climate change. So, you know, a lot of the people at the, I would say, the more grassroots end of things know that nuclear, you know, is not a good deal for the public.
OK, well, Nikki from the Stop Hinkley campaign, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Thank you, Tony.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.